Michael Savage Show contains adult language, adult content, psychological nudity. Listener discretion is advised.
Now, America's most exciting radio talk show, The Savage Nation. Here is Michael Savage.
See somewhere waiting for me. My lover stands on golden sands and watches the ships that go sailing.
It is the Savage Nation for Wednesday, December 5th, 2007. Thanks, Bobby. Give him a few chips and we'll see him in heaven with the 72 virgins. Well, it's open mic to Mike Wednesday. I don't want to talk about the mall shooting in Omaha again. I don't want to talk about the surge is working, so now Iran is not working. 2 days ago, the schmuck who said that Iran is not developing nuclear weapons, the Democrat plant in the State Department, that schmuck said 3 days ago they were developing nuclear weapons. And, of course, the newspapers ate it right up. So, you know what? You lead. You lead with your brain scan here on the Savage Nation. If you want to open mic it, go ahead, 1-800-449-8255. Or go onto my website and see what stories we've posted at michaelsavage.com. What I find amusing, and very amusing, is that we have a major storm, a big one, blowing into America on the very day that the morons in the Senate are debating carbon credits and global warming. Do these people live in another world? The record for snowfall in Maine is tying a record from 1890. Hello, that was before the automobile. North Dakota has broken a 1926 record for snowfall, but the schmucks in the Senate are debating global warming and how to tie up the economy and to seduce the Americans into this fraudulent Al Gorean reality here. Don't they know that it's snowing outside, these putzes? No, they don't. They don't know anything. Most of them are on medication. See, I'm convinced that's the reason the West is in trouble. It's not so much that we have a moral meltdown. That's been a long-standing problem. It's that we are medicated. We have a subdued, hypnotically controlled society, mainly in the leadership, that is on Prozac-like substances, and they don't know reality. They're not living in reality. That's why we're all in such danger, which is why a huckster like Huckabee can be moving up in the polls. Why is Huckster B moving up in the polls? No one knows who he is. Because the pollsters need to make a living. And the way pollsters make a living is they run a poll every day with 724 schmendricks they call. 724 people they call. He's up, she's down. She's down, he's up, he's up, she's down. And then they put ads on their blog. And you're supposed to believe a word of it. I've never been called by a pollster. I don't know anybody who's ever been called by a pollster. Or something like that. I read in the news pages, the food pages, that a drink, a very dangerous drink named absinthe, has made a comeback. I read that the Bureau of Alcohol, Tobacco, and Firearms, or whatever it's called, has said that it's okay to drink it. First time since 1912, it was made illegal. Now, the reason it was made illegal, absinthe, is because people have become absinthomaniacs. I read on this in great detail when I was in ethnobotany and pharmacology. Very dangerous drink. I know they're saying that the new ones have to have no thujone in it, which is hallucinogenic, but I guarantee you this stuff is poison. Why anybody would want to poison themselves like this, I don't know, but then I don't know an awful lot about what motivates people to damage their bodies and their minds. So if you want to now drink like the schmuck next to you, have an absinthe to show how cool you are, go ahead. Whatever they tell you in the newspaper, you'll do anyway because you're a sheeple. I also read in the food pages that the entree, and you know, entree, A, not Not come on, come in. Not that kind of entree. The entree in a dinner. Not come in, entree. But the E-N-T-R-E-E, entree, is no longer popular amongst the fools in restaurants. They want little offerings that they pay through the nose for. Side dishes, small dishes. The morons like small dishes, which is why I'd never eat in a trendy restaurant. I don't go there to eat in trendy restaurants. Plates of cheese, crudy, cheese boards, side dishes. The people have there's no limit to the stupidity of the west of the public, but hey, they're entitled to it. It's a free country. If you don't mind, I like an entree. I don't even like appetizers. I've reversed my eating. I never eat an appetizer. What do I need appetizer for? I'm not underweight. Appetizer to make me hungry? Why an appetizer? I would eliminate the appetizer. But look, the people want to eat appetizers and no entree. I can't help it. So the restaurant owners are only too glad to increase the price of the appetizers. What do you care? I see that the wine prices are going to go through the ceiling soon because of the high price of the euro, European wines. Price of oil is up, dollar is plunged, euro is up. So they say that the European wines are soon going to go up in price. Good luck to them. What do I care? Let it go up. Let it go down. So people drink California wine. Let them drink California wine and enjoy it. See, these are not important stories. That's why I like them. You know, I never eat dessert. Did you know that's why I'm still walking the earth? Do you realize I never eat dessert? Never. Okay, once a year I'll have a piece of dessert. Desserts almost killed me as a child. I found out that the dessert is the biggest poison in your life. When they wheel out the dessert cart, it's time to pay and go. Play Bobby Darin again. I'm not warmed up yet. I don't want to talk about care. I don't want to talk about them raising money for me, my defense fund. Somewhere you want to send money, send it. That's all. Do what you got to do. So far, not a dime came in from anyone I know. Nobody. Nobody I know sent 10 cents. Hey, Mike. Hey, Mike. All my friends. Not a nickel. I have no friends, I found it. I have no friends in the world. Except for Craig Smith of Swiss America and one program director. I don't know whether to mention his name, but I will if he wants me to. You find out at the end of the day you're alone. You're born alone and you die alone. That's the world we live in. Big boo-hoo. Okay, boo-hoo. Okay, I created this problem. I'll get myself out of it. That's all. Turn that off. I like it, but, you know, I'm not in the mood for it. I'm not in the mood for anything. It's me and Teddy facing the world. My attack poodle. My 11-pound attack poodle. That's me and the dog facing the universe. And, of course, the law. The law is on my side, and I believe in the law, so I'm a law-abiding man. I always have been. And we'll see. It'll play itself out in the courts. I assume I'm going to prevail. I've heard many legal opinions telling me that I'm going to recover the damages that have been done to my reputation and to my show. And we'll have to see. We'll play it out. But I want to repeat to you from the beginning, from the get-go, from the starting gate, right now, where this started. I had heard of CARE for years. I didn't care for what they were doing with the Imam lawsuit, but I really paid no attention to them. I was never really on their case, never. I figured they're a pressure group like any other civil rights group, and they're going to try and make as much money as they can and as much trouble as they can and let others deal with it. But when they went after me to destroy me, advertiser by advertiser, I had no choice but to sue them, which is what I have done. And now you understand I'm in the battle of my life, the legal battle of my life, and a battle for the freedom of speech, not only for me, but for everybody in this talk radio business. Because if they put me out of business, who's going to be next? You know who'll be next? The ones who aren't helping me. That's who'll be next. But I can't help them. If the Blarney blower up there, if the Blarney thrower doesn't understand the danger he's in, he is really a bigger fool than I think. Wallbanger, I wouldn't expect to know anything. I think from all the years of pounding walls, his brain is sort of soft. But that's all. What do you want to talk about? I don't really want to talk about any of this right now. Let's talk about Las Vegas. There's a big fight in Vegas this weekend, which I'm invited to go to. The seats are $15,000 a piece, and I've turned it down. Would you believe this? Floyd Mayweather versus an Englishman named Hatton. And this guy, I mean, you know, look, Mayweather's a tough fighter. But you don't see white guys who can fight anymore, except they come out of the Ukraine, They come out of the Ukraine like from the blizzards. And all of a sudden, there's like these white Goliaths who can actually fight in the ring and win. It's shocking. Like, you know, I can't believe these guys. Why are they so tough from Russia? What is it? The years of deprivation, natural selection, everyone died off from the war and the pestilence and the snow, and the ones who were left are like Superman. I don't know. What is it about the Ukrainian gene that permits them to be such amazing, like bulldozers in the ring? Anyway, but this guy's English. How can the English still fight like this? This guy's like an old style, you know, like wharf guy who could beat up eight people at once. What's his name? Hatton. I like the fights. I like to go. I may go. I may not go. I may watch it after it's over. I've been invited to go, but don't call me about it. Most people don't even know what I'm talking about. You know, it's the funny thing is most of the things I'm interested in, my audience isn't interested in. They don't even like fighting. It's such a small audience in this country for boxing. It's amazing to me. I enjoy the fights. I like the whole rivalry. What I really like almost as much as the fighting is the amazing sportsmanship in boxing. I cannot say that I really like extreme fighting as much. It's a little too brutal for me. It's too much like the Roman arena. I don't like seeing handsome, strong men being whipped into a pulp and begging to be, you know, let off by pounding. I don't know. There's something about it. Even when I was a kid, if I got into a fight when I was going to be victorious, I stopped pounding on the other guy. The minute I saw that I had won, I would stop. It's my weakness. I admit it. I have a weak spot in me. I don't know what you might call it, but I never like to see the other man defeated. Would you believe that? That's a strange thing about me. I don't know if it's a strength or a weakness. So it's the same with fighting. Like if I go to the fights, in a boxing match, they will usually stop it if the other guy is in bad shape. Whereas with the extreme fighting, the cage fighting, they pound the other guy's head on the ground, you know? I do like Las Vegas, particularly in the winter. I kind of love Las Vegas in the winter. In the summer, you need to be a lizard. You need to have been mated by a lizard and like a snake to go there. And I enjoy this. Something about Las Vegas in the winter. The desert in the winter is gorgeous. I saw a documentary last night on the guy who insulted everybody. What was his name? They did a documentary, like a puff piece on him. He died last year. He was the sharpest of the put-down artists of the comedians. Does anyone know who I'm talking about, why I'm rambling on about this? Not Dangerfield. He's a lightweight compared to the guy who always appeared in Las Vegas. He was with the Rat Pack. He goes back 5,000 years. He goes back to Jack Benny. Does anyone know who I'm talking about? Who was the guy who was the biggest put-down artist in the world? Not Joey Bishop. Another guy. I think he died with... Who am I talking about? Whoever knows who I'm talking about. Rickles. Don Rickles. I saw this documentary done by a documentarian because I'm like involved with the documentary about my life. If I go ahead with it, I'm not sure I will. I'm not sure I need this glorification at this point in my life if I even want it. Maybe not. I have to think about this very carefully. What's it going to be, in a mausoleum? You press a button and there's Michael Savage's life story? Who am I doing it for? Rickles is still alive? I'm sorry. He didn't look like he was alive in the movie. I got to tell you that. I mean, he didn't look too alive. I mean... You know, there's a certain point when a person should stop performing. It goes for me and everyone else. Johnny Carson was the genius of when to get off the stage. He quit like, I don't know, 18, 15 years before. He could have. This guy was like old man performing. Why? Don't they know when to stop? You get the white hat, you disappear, and no one ever has to hear from you. You play Pinochle. You sit on a boardwalk with your pants legs rolled up above your knees in Brighton Beach. But you don't perform when you can hardly walk out on the stage. It's not pleasant for people. It's painful. You know, like a woman who would make love to a man when she doesn't want to, what was called a mercy something. You know what I'm saying? You get it? When you are sitting in an audience with a guy like that at that age, it's a mercy audience. But I can't use the proper word. I'll be right back. Savage. So here's a little story out of Brooklyn, New York. Neighbors in a Brooklyn neighborhood, remember a woman who died at least a year ago without anyone knowing. She died a year ago, you hear? That's the America of today. Now, that's the world we live in, this disconnect from reality. What are you going to do? That's the world we're in. Now, if you want to go on to michaelsavage.com, you want to read the website, you want to make a donation, between now and Christmas, do it. Read the website. If you think freedom of speech is important, then contribute to the Legal Defense Fund. Or if you have a specific question, otherwise I really don't think I'm going to talk much about any of that today, unless you want me to. If you want me to. A far bigger story is the Iran nuclear weapons program, the about face. I believe that we've been duped by the Democrat Party. And that's because the surge is working in Iraq. They no longer can say Iraq is the problem. So now they're turning it to Iran, and they're saying, how dare you Republicans even talk bad about Iran? Why, they're our best friends. Now, if that's not sedition on the part of the Democrat Party, particularly this vermin inside the State Department, who should be indicted, by the way, this man in the State Department who just a few weeks ago reported that Iran was developing nuclear weapons, now this verminous rat turns around with a new intelligence report and says, no, they're no threat. They haven't been for 5 years. This man should be tried for treason. But we don't have an opposition government anymore. There's no opposition party. They are fighting only for their own party, not for the American people or for the truth. So it's enough to take the guts out of you, to not care the wind out of your sails. That's why I'm talking about global warming. Why? It's the biggest blizzard since 1890 in Maine, biggest blizzard since 1920s in the Midwest, and these morons are in the Senate discussing global warming and imposing a tax on us. It's Alice in Wonderland. That's why a huckster like Huckabee can be rising in these small polls. So to make a long story short, I was talking about, I can't warm up. It's too many breaks. I can't deal with this. My mind is broken from the breaks. Do you know that? I develop an idea. Bingo already. The next thing is the bingo. I can't think. My mind can't work. I need 12, 15 minutes to think. 3 minutes already. Bango. I'm out of here already. I got to tell you, I'll be right back. I don't really want this anymore. I think I might just leave radio and you'll never hear from me again. No books, no movie. I'll disappear from the public eye and you'll be all better off. You won't have Michael Savage to hate anymore and I'll be gone. You know what? You can enjoy listening to the government media complex spending an overdrive 24/7, but you won't have me to kick around anymore. I'll be gone. And that's where I'll probably be going.
Savage.
Danny Thomas, great, great star. Really is. And I kid about Danny many, many times. It's good to see you again, Danny, and all the baloney about the Jewish people and the Egyptians with war. Nonsense. I love and respect you. I say this from my heart in your native tongue. Masalamaha nimikai mahana. Which means I never want you around me. You understand that, Danny? No, he's a great... You ever see his nose? When he breathes, the lip gets sucked right up. You're not Lebanese, you're a hawk.
Don Rickles, again, he's a very funny put-down artist. There's no question about it. And all spontaneous, made up on the spot. Probably the master of put-downs. But, you know, here he was goofing about Danny Thomas, who I think was Lebanese. And it was funny, and you could laugh at it, but that was done like in the 60s. Go try to do something as funny as that today. Everyone is oh so sensitive. We're living in a sort of a crypto-fascism of sensitivity. All of these sensitivity trainers out there. I wonder what they say behind closed doors. Don, here's a study that I put up on michaelsavage.com. Abortion is fueling the cancer epidemic. Having an abortion raises a woman's risk of breast cancer by at least 30%, according to a major new study by British researchers. And it's published in a major journal. And an abortion in a young woman who has never had a child has a carcinogenic effect. You don't want to hear this, many of you leftists, but it's a reality. The people who are fighting it are those in the American Cancer Society and those in the abortion rackets. For years, medical professionals have seen a linkage between abortions and cancer in women. And it's been rejected by, of course, the special interests, mainly the national organizations that make a lot of money on abortions. But women, pay attention to what I've just said to you. Oh, an abortion in a young woman who has never had a child has a carcinogenic effect. And it's explained why in the article, and I'm not going to read it out. Ireland has the lowest breast cancer rates in the British Islands. It also has the lowest abortion rates. Did you know that? You didn't know that. Ireland, which has the lowest breast cancer rates in the British Isles, also has the lowest abortion rates. And they say one puzzling fact is that women from upper social classes had more breast cancer. The more highly paid women get more breast cancer, and it's unexplained. We could say it's stress. I don't really know. But that's something within the study. It makes a lot of biologic sense, this study. Now I'll take your calls. Pauline, WOR, welcome to the Savage Nation.
Hi, Michael. I just wanted to let you know that I love you immensely. I think you're unbelievable. You're a man's man. You're my.
I don't know if I'm a man's man. I'm just another person. I'm from another era, from another age. It's dead in America, what I represent. I mean, I've been around a fairly long time. I'm just from another time, that's all. This is how people were in my day.
I appreciate that, because I know what that is. Believe me.
I appreciate your care for me. Thank you very much. Honolulu, Hawaii. Dave, you're next up. Go ahead, please.
Mike, you're wrong. It's not dead. It's alive and well. I'm 37 years old, and I believe in what you're saying. I believe so much I'm sending $1,000 to your fight. And all the Savage listeners need to wise up and get in on this fight, because we are losing our country by inaction. And, Mike, please don't be down, Mike. Keep your spirits up. You're doing God's work for this country, and we need you bad, man.
Well, don't get me wrong. I'm going to fight this one out to the end. But that's not, I'm talking about the larger, bigger scheme of things. This, I have no choice in this. I have to take this to where it has to go. And I want to make a commitment right here on this show right now, for those of you who are cynical about everything, and you should be, or skeptical is a more correct word, and you don't trust anybody, including me. And I understand that I'm a skeptic by nature. Any dollar that people send into this legal defense fund, I am not going to spend on myself. And if it's not spent on legal fees, I'm going to return it at the end of the process. You follow what I'm saying? It's not going to go into a slush fund, which I keep.
No,
I want to make that commitment, and I want to make it clear. Both Daniel Horowitz, my attorney, and I agree on that. That we'll use the funds that we need to fight this battle, but any money we don't use will be returned to the sender at the end of the day. And that's it. I don't know how else to put it. I don't know how much this is going to cost. I know that the other side has $20 million in the kitty, and they may want to fight this. You know, they started this by attacking me, and I'm fighting for my life. That's all, for my professional life. Why I'm playing Don Rickles, I really don't know. I know why, because I'm thinking about doing this documentary, and I watched this puff piece on Don Rickles. It was pretty good. It's like, you know, him performing in Vegas. Some of the video was excellent. Early footage of Vegas in the 60s with the Rat Pack is great stuff. And I enjoyed it. I was in bed last night watching that with Teddy. He kind of liked it, too. I watch him. He tries to sneak in a look. He makes believe he's sleeping, but I look under his floppy ears to see if his eyes are lit up. I creep around on the bed, and I look under the hair. And if I see this light of the screen in his eyes, I know he's cheating and looking at the television screen. Dogs are funny. They don't actually want you to know they're enjoying themselves. He was enjoying that documentary. He enjoyed the early scenes of Las Vegas. I'm just relaxing right now. I really am. I'm going to take it easy today. I could play a lot of stuff. I got a lot of hot stories. You want me to talk about abortion fueling cancer epidemic? You want me to talk about the enemy within our own government taking the side of the Iranian Hitler? I mean, I could do that. But that really is, right now, not what I want to do. You want to talk about absinthe, which the schmucks will soon start drinking? That it's been brought back, even though it's a toxic poison. I'm sure the people can't wait to poison their brains even further. Oh, I'll have an absinthe. Have you tried absinthe? It's really cool. Everything has to be cool. The cool people are the people who worry me. The cool people are so uncool. Breaking news, deadly shooting at Omaha Mall, shooter at large. Young black male dressed in army clothing. You won't see that in the papers, though. It doesn't fit the imagery that's required to be carried by the news. Now, if the shooter was Timothy McVeigh, Wolf Blitzer would have already needed a new stack of the pens to report it. He would have been running already, screaming,
"Oh, white male in army fatigue shot people in a mall. We'll have the latest."
You rats, you media vermin, you. How you kill this country. This is why I'm not popular. I speak from the heart. What else do you want to talk about? Hawaii and the ethnic grievance industry. Under legislation that the House of Representatives has voted 261 to 153, they're going to empower a panel to decide who is a native Hawaiian, who will then be entitled to special privileges and immunities. And because there are perhaps only 7,000 pure native Hawaiians, they're going to have to decide who has Hawaiian blood. Now, I don't know how they're going to do that, because there are people who have part Hawaiian blood, and I don't know if they're going to qualify for the special privileges. They may have to get Goring's son from Germany to write up the new protocols on how to investigate people's ethnicity. See, this is the new America. It's neo-fascistic under the guise of the liberals that are pushing everything. They're actually, they step right into the shoes of neo-fascism. What do you want to talk about? Trucks, global warming, local hoes, Don Rickles, fighting? Should I go? No, I don't want to do that. There's some isn't there an interesting question? How about a request? Can I take a request? Are there any requests out there? You're going to all want, like, family stories. You hate my politics, but you love my family stories. I don't have any more. I've told you every family story there is to tell. I didn't make any of them up. I'm amazed I have so many. Whether it be Louis bending the nail, or One-Arm Frank, or Fat Al's tuna. You people have bought all my books already. I mean, how much can a man do? You know, I'll tell you what's getting to me, what's really underneath it all. I'm starting to think about it. This is the problem. You know the phrase in the Bible, don't look back? When Lot's wife looked back, she turned to a pillar of salt. I think that's what's starting to get to me. You see, I met with the film people. And I had to dig up all of my archives, all of my Super 8 and Kodachrome movies, all of the Nikon F. Remember those days of the Nikon F? Like late 60s, early 70s, the Nikon F cameras, how great they were, that shutter release sound. And we all did like Kodachrome shots of everything. And remember, I was collecting plants in those days. Those were the best pictures I ever took in my life. Fiji, blah, blah, blah. But when you start looking back at family pictures and you look back at your deceased relatives and you start to say, what do you want to include in a thing about your life, and what do you want to include in your autobiography? And I tell you something else. Those of you who are the loyal listeners, do you remember I read two pieces on this show, I think it was last Friday, from an autobiography that I found that I wrote in 1988? Remember I said I would never do it again? I mean, a lot of this stuff is dredging up a lot of the past. And I'm not so sure I want to do this anymore. You can't look back at a certain point. How do you define your own life? What do you tell? What do you choose to include? Where is the set and where is the frame of your life? What is important? How do you judge your life? Is it by the achievements, what you've done, degrees you've earned, books you've written, how do you judge what your life is? Who judges that for you? You let the vermin in the media, who distort everything you've done and reduce it down to something that they say you did that wasn't done? Is that who you are? You know, in the age we live in with YouTube and with perverts writing things on Wikipedia, changing reality for the sake of politics, I ask you, who is a person and what is their legacy? Who can have a legacy in this age of instant distortion? Who can have a real legacy in this age of instant distortion? Los Angeles, TJ, welcome to the Savage Nation. Go ahead, please.
Dr. Savage, I know you're a big fan of boxing. I just wanted to get your take this weekend coming up on Mayweather and Ricky Hatton. They're both undefeated. It's highly heralded as a great fight. Just want to know what you thought.
You mean who I think is going to win?
Yes, sir. Yes, sir. Floyd Mayweather or Ricky Hatton. They're both undefeated. Just wanted to know.
Well, I don't know. I have to say I don't know. I would think that Mayweather's going to win, but I'm rooting for Hatton, not because I'm white and he's white, but because I think he's the underdog, actually. I always seem to root for the underdog, and I think Hatton is the underdog. I think Mayweather's if I were a betting man, my guess is that we'd have he would definitely be the favorite. Does anyone know what the bet is on this fight, Mayweather or Hatton? Does anyone have the odds on this fight? Is there a gambling guy out there who give me the odds on this fight right now? I'd love to hear that. I would love to hear the odds on. Do you know what the odds are?
Well, he's the favorite. You know, Mayweather is.
Yep. No. I want a guy out of Las Vegas to call this show and tell me what the betting people are, where the money's going on this fight. I'd love to hear this. But we'll keep talking amongst ourselves on other topics. I'm getting the good ones in now. Now they're coming into the tent. Have you been on michaelsavage.com and seen the picture of Teddy? That's the important thing. You click on here for a larger version of this picture. That's what I like. There's Teddy and Mike. And behind it, you see a little life preserver ring. It says Patriot San Francisco. That's the name of my old boat. I'm going to save the life rings of every one of my boats. I've only had one. That's not true. I had many boats before this. You ever tell you my boating stories? I think this is as good a time as any to tell a story. I am going to tell you the story about my first boat. It was called a Tarangi. It was a wooden sailing catch. It was 22 feet long, and I got it when I was in Hawaii, and it had no engine. And I will tell you that when I come back, because I was driven out to sea and almost died when I come back right here in the Savage Nation. Savage. Playing Hawaiian music because, first of all, I'd like to be there right now, truthfully. But I'm going to wait it out. I'm going to go in January, maybe. Great place. It's a great place. Great. I lived there for a number of years, you know. You know what it's like for a kid from New York to go, like, to wind up in Hawaii? I'd never been in a place like that. It was unbelievable. It was like walking into, a heaven itself. So anyway, to make a long story short, we're talking about a turn it off now, a long time ago. You know, when you land in heaven, you think you can do anything, and you have hubris. Hubris is a sense of confidence that only children and the mad have and can understand. But when a grown-up has hubris, it becomes very dangerous, and in my case, that was true. So you get to the islands, and it's a magical time. You never saw sunsets like this. They can break your heart. When you see plumeria blossoms lying on the, you know, I used to bicycle up to the university. I would see plumeria blossoms lying on the sidewalk. I would stop the bicycle and pick up the plumeria blossoms and look at them and smell them. And I'd never seen anything like this. Sure, I had seen rose petals on the fence in the Bronx when I was a little kid. They were soft and beautiful. But this was something unique. The scent was unlike anything I had ever experienced. And so you see these sunsets and these sunrises and all of these things that you have never seen, and birds in the jungles in the back of the rainforest that you never saw or heard before. And you start to get tuned into your own body in a way you've never been tuned in. If you've never lived in the tropics and it's the first time, and you start shedding clothing and shoes and leather, and you put it all away, and now you're in flip-flops, and then you're in shorts, and all of a sudden at night the breeze comes through your sleeves, and you start to become alive in a new way, and you go in the warm water. So you start to feel like the original man. And you buy a sailboat. It's the first thing you do. And so I bought a sloop-rigged boat. She was not catch-rigged. I was mistaken. I remember now. Tarangi was a sloop-rigged sailing vessel, about 22 feet long. And it was made of white oak, primarily. And it had been built in Oregon and sailed out by somebody else to Hawaii. I bought it for nothing, you know, next to nothing. She was in perfect shape and no engine, as I said. So I buy this boat. I put it into the Alawai Yacht Harbor. And that's where I kept it. And, you know, most people who own boats mainly use them to drink on and hang out. And it's as good a thing to do as any. But I was foolish enough to actually want to sail the boat, even though I knew nothing about sailing. And I took it out without an engine. I knew it was pretty easy to get out because the wind was prevailing out of the yacht harbor. And I said, wow, this is great. And so I, you know, with a few friends, I was on a boat alone. They just cast me off, released the lines, pushed me backwards. And there we go, down the Alawai Channel, out into the channel, and out into the ocean. I was zipping along with the sail out, and I was zipping along out onto sea, and there I was. I said, this is super. I'm really enjoying myself. Then I realized I didn't know how to get back. I said, how do I turn this thing around if the wind is blowing out? Well, I didn't know how. And I said, well, I better figure this out, because if this keeps up for a while, I'll soon be out in the middle of the Pacific Ocean, and there'll be no way back at all. I had no flares, no radio, no engine. All I had was confidence that was bordering on the insane. The first thing I did was I resorted to common sense, and I dropped the sails, because that, of course, would cut the motion of the boat. I dropped the sails, and using the tiller, I turned the boat around, you know, flip-flop, flip-flop. Until I got the boat pointing back towards the land, And then I figured if the wind is blowing against me, there must be a way to go into a prevailing wind and still move against it. I've seen other people do it. And little by little, and lo and behold, I was able to, luckily, I don't know whether it was current or God's hand itself pushed me back into the harbor, but I learned quickly that sailing is not for the amateur. That's all there was to it. So those days are over. But she was my first boat. I don't have a life ring from Tarangi because I didn't even have a life ring. I don't even think I had a life preserver. You know, those were the age. That was an age when people had total, like, madness about what they could do and accomplish in the late 60s. But now I drive a powerboat, and it has all sorts of safety equipment on it. Sure, not enough that I should have. But I like powerboats a lot better because they're easier to get out. I can get this thing out of the way. It's 45 feet, twin diesels, 19 tons, unladen with fuel and water, and I can go out on it alone and come back on it alone in almost any wind. And that's the good part. You can get out in 12, 15 minutes. And there it is. It's just you and the birds and the water and the land, and that's it. And that's what I go out for now, is just to look at the water and look at the birds and look at the landforms, mainly, and the seals I like. And I can name every bird on the bay. More or less, I know every bird on the bay as a species. Not by name, not like, how you doing, howdy. I don't mean that. Species-wise. I've come to understand that every animal has a personality. Isn't this strange? It's not that the PETA folks are correct. I still eat animals. But they all have a personality when you get to know them, and they all want to live. Dad taught me that everything wants to live. That's how he taught me to respect human life. He said, you'll notice that a cat wants to live, a dog wants to live, a rat wants to live, a mouse wants to live, a bird wants to live. And he had learned that when he had accidentally shot a bird as a kid. Remember, this is odd to a country boy listening to the show. It sounds very weak. But remember, I'm a New York City boy. And to us, it's a different experience than it is to you guys. I respect your ability to hunt for your food. But every animal actually has a personality when you get to know that animal. They're all different. Just as we're all different, every human is unique and like a snowflake. Well, guess what? So are animals. They're all unique. It's amazing when you come to understand that. But that's it. That's the way of all flesh. I'll be back, and I will definitely be more political in the next hour.
Savage.
Warning. The Michael Savage Show contains adult language, adult content, psychological nudity. Listener discretion is advised.
Now, America's most exciting radio talk show, The Savage Nation. Here is Michael Savage.
Do not go gentle into that good night. Old age should burn and rave at close of day. Rage, rage against the dying of the light.
Danny Thomas, great, great star. Really is. And I kid about Danny many, many times. It's good to see you again, Danny, and all the baloney about the Jewish people and the Egyptians with war. Nonsense. I love and respect you. I say this from my heart in your native tongue. Masalamaha nimikai mahana. Which means I never want you around me. You understand that, Danny? No, he's a great... You ever see his nose when he breathes? The lip gets sucked right up.
That's it. From the Dylan Thomas tragedy of life to the Don Rickles comedy of life. It's the tragicomic world, according to Michael Savage. We're talking about many topics. If you just joined us, it's unfortunate because I think we had a pretty good hour. One of the topics, I think, was the odds on the Hatton-Mayweather fight. And I asked for somebody from Vegas who knows the odds in this big fight to call. We have one guy who's calling. Tom from Las Vegas, welcome to the program.
Good afternoon, Michael. This is Tom from Las Vegas. The odds on the fight are -240 Merriweather, which means you have to lay 240 to win 100 if you want to bet Merriweather.
You're kidding. So Hatton is the favorite?
No. Hatton's the underdog by 240.
Let's say for the average guy out there, Tom, who's not a bettor, he puts $100 down on Mayweather. What could he win if Mayweather wins?
He has to put down 240 to win 100. He has to put down 240 to win 100.
On who? But so who's the favorite?
Mayweather.
Oh, Mayweather is the favorite.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, that's what I thought. So that's why I'm rooting for Hatton, who is definitely the underdog, right?
Yeah, Hatton's the underdog. It opened up at the beginning of the week at 3-1 underdog. But they've bet him down a little bit to 240.
Wow.
The sports book, that's right, Kern. I just talked to the guy.
So, Tom, there. Let me ask you something. Is this hype? Is this fight all hype then? I mean, this fight's pretty much going to go to Mayweather.
There's a couple of things. The fact is that Mayweather, I don't know whether, you know, he's going to be in focus totally, because he's got a lot of business ventures now that he didn't have when his younger days, you know. And this kid's a pretty tough kid. He's beat three fighters that Mayweather fought over the years. You know, they were at their peak when they fought Mayweather, but they were a little bit over their peak when they fought Hatton. Mm. But he's a very tough kid, and he's very dedicated, and he's fighting, he thinks, you know, for a great cause, to bring the title to London and what have you.
Yeah. So is this a big deal in Vegas this weekend? It's got to be a gigantic draw, right?
Yeah, huge fight.
I was told that the seats are $15,000 a piece near the ring. Is that the number you're hearing?
I hear $10,000, $12,000. I'll be at the fight. I have a ticket, in fact.
Amazing.
One of my customers gave me a ticket today.
Good for you, Tom. Thanks for calling the show. I'm proud that you're a listener of the program. I got such a diverse listenership. It's beautiful to hear it. You don't really know it when you're sitting alone in a studio. This is the horror of radio. You have no idea who you're talking to. I guess maybe, like, if you do a club scene, you got 300-400 people out there, you can see the people. You can get so disconnected from reality in radio. You know, I had 10 million listeners, 20, I don't know what it is, right? You only go by the rating statistics, but you don't see the people. I can understand why performers need to go out into the real world and see the audience to know what they're talking about. I don't know, maybe I should go to the fight now. I went to one, I told you who was in the audience. I could believe it. The last fight I went to, Klitschko was sitting four seats down from me, got pictures with him, one of my heroes. This guy's like a Roman gladiator, Klitschko the Russian. The guy is like movie star handsome, a PhD, and a boxer, heavyweight champion. He said, it's a pretty hard combination. He's not like a punch-drunk guy. But six rows behind me was Harry Reid. Four rows to the left was John McCain and Cindy. So there's an awful lot of fight fans in this world. I got to tell you that. You don't hear much about it. It's an older sport that I don't know if it's making a comeback, because I think most of the young people, if they like any martial sports, they like martial arts or they like cage fighting. I don't think they really like boxing. It's not brutal enough for them. They're a little more into the brutality, I think. Waterbury, Connecticut. Walter, welcome to the Savage Nation.
Yes, good afternoon, Doctor. I hope you find this interesting. When you were relating your story about when you were a child and you got into a fight and you have a guy in trouble and you couldn't put him away, it reminded me of a conversation I had with a former mayor here who had a quite good amateur career. In fact, he won the Golden Gloves in Boston and in his weight category back in the 30s. After winning the Golden Gloves, he went to his manager and he says, I guess it's time to turn pro, right? He says, no, you're not turning pro. He says, you're a good amateur, but you'll get killed as a pro because you don't have killer instinct.
Isn't that interesting? My dad taught me that. When we would watch the fights, he would always say to me, watch this fight carefully. The one who's going to win is the one who's hungrier and the one who has the killer instinct. Now, it's true in every field of endeavor, by the way, Walter, whether it be stock brokerage or virtually the law, you name it. Whoever is hungrier and has the killer instinct usually wins. Isn't that true?
Yeah, I agree with you 100%. And that's why I called tonight. And thanks very much, sir.
Thank you. Now, I'm going to take this to the political level, and you're going to get scared now. You're looking at a world map. Who has the killer instinct and who's hungrier? America, Iran, or name a few other countries. And that's what worries me. Yeah, we're the big guy in the ring, but we're like a big punch-drunk oaf walking around there, stumbling around. It's like a Joe Palooka, 300 pounds, all muscle, and then you got a guy who's lean and mean who hates you and wants to take you apart at the joints. And his name is Ahmadinejad. He is the ugliest man on the planet. He is mean, he is ugly, he's filled with hatred. mean and ugly and filled with hatred. And on top of it all, he has enemies inside your camp who are undermining you in the State Department. That's what worries me here. You get it? Albany, New York. John, you're on the Savage Nation.
Hello, Michael. Nice to talk to you. Listen.
Thank you.
Earlier you mentioned, who am I? How do you know who you are in this YouTube world? And I completely agree. But let me tell you, I believe with certainty that you are who you are because of your relationships. You are not defined by what you do or what you have or what other people say about you or even what you say about yourself, for that matter. Men in particular I'm talking about, not everybody, it's true for everybody, but men in particular, we are defined by our relationships. That's what makes us who we are. Everything else is secondary. And who I am gives me the buoyancy to go out and do the things that I ought to do. And acquire the things that I ought to acquire for my wife and for my children and for my
family. When you say that a man is defined, a person is defined by his or her relationships, is that your primary theorem?
Point.
Yes?
Yes, yes.
Well, I'm not sure that that's true. I mean, personally, I don't think that's true, and I'll tell you why. You cannot permit other people to define who you are. What if a person is different than the average person? And what if that different person may look gruff and may look mean, but inside he's a different person, and he doesn't do any harm to the people, but he doesn't go out of his way to be particularly nice or kind? You're going to let them define you?
Well, let me take it for this point. My primary relationship is God. God defines me initially. I am more than just a creation.
I understand that, but YouTube doesn't know your relationship with God. In other words, YouTube's going to show a physical manifestation of you and your events or what you have done, okay? A production, a creativity, a creation of a man is a physical manifestation of some part of his soul, perhaps, if it's a genuine piece of art. But what makes a great artist differ from a schlock artist is that the great artist, let's say Michelangelo, I'm taking a name that people may know in this day and age. I don't know who anybody knows anybody anymore. But if you look at a sculpture of Rodin, okay, which I have done for years, you go to a museum, you could see it. You could see a manifestation of the greatness in his soul through the marble that he cut, okay? But is that the man? I would guarantee he has had some wife somewhere who hated him, who said he was mean because he cheated on her, for example. Or what is Picasso? Is Picasso to be viewed as the man who created these great works of art? Or is it Picasso's children who will tell us who Picasso was? You see what I'm getting at?
I completely see where you get. It is very dicey in this world that we live in. There's no question about it. I mean, I talk to my children all the time. I say, you guys are on I am all the time. You don't even know how to have a freaking relationship, for crying out loud. But I invest my time and my energy into my children.
You've got to. You've got to, but it doesn't always come back to you, John.
It does not
always come back to you the way you put it out either, John.
Give it back to my father the same way. The truth of the matter is I'm my own free moral agent, and so are they.
That's interesting. And right, and all you can do is what you think is the best and go out of your way over and over and over again with people, even if you get slapped in the face. The last thing you want to do is wind up being like them.
And I thank God.
That's the message through the ages is don't go down to their level. And you could apply that to a political arena. You could apply it to a personal arena. You could apply it to virtually any arena. You're riding on a highway. An idiot cuts you off and gives you a finger. You have a choice. You can let the blood get control of your brain and you could speed up and give him a finger and cut him off and jump out with a gun and kill each other. Or you could shrug and say another moron. I mean, what do you want to do here? It's the same in life. This road rage thing is a manifestation of people's misery inside their own heads. I had one today. A woman in a van was blocking me. I don't have patience for people who chat on a cell phone and are creeping and zigzagging on a small road, zigzagging and almost in my lane. So I hunker and I give her a pass. That's all I had to do. Now she steamed up at me already that I didn't let her zigzag and slow everyone down. She's on my tail giving me the finger. You hear this? What am I going to do? Get out of the car and start yelling at this crazy? You know what I did? So you get to a light, now she's behind you. What are you going to do? She's looking at me in the mirror and yelling and screaming, and I'm looking at her face in the mirror screaming at me because I had the nerve to not let her block me and blah, blah, blah. You know what I did? I took my finger and I ran it like in a circle, like when you show someone's crazy. I looked at her. I opened my eyes wide. I looked her right in the eye in the mirror, and I went with my finger in a circle like, crazy. Well, you know that didn't make her too happy. Fortunately, I had a V12 and she was stuck in a van. I'll be right back.
Savage.
Now on the sidewalk, ooh, Sunday morning, lies a body just oozing life. Eek! And someone sneaking round the corner.
Hey.
Could that someone be Mac, the Knife?
Who was Mac the Knife? Why was the song so big? I don't care. 1-800-449-8255. We're having an easy day. I can, you know, tell you all I know about CARE and the lawsuit. I've done it for days. I'll do it again. You can visit my website and read the lawsuit. You can see what you want to do. You can judge for yourself whether it's a worthwhile fight. And you could join the fight or you could choose to sit on the sidelines. I mean, I'll leave it up to you. If you don't know what I'm talking about, I'll get into it a little later. Right now, what I want to do is go into the callers. Las Vegas, Nevada. Mark, welcome to the Savage Nation. Go ahead, please.
Dr. Savage, I live here in Vegas, and I'm going to tell you right now, you cannot get accurate odds. You know why?
No.
Because the English are coming here by the droves, man. And as they come in, the odds for Mayweather is decreasing because, you know how...
Oh, because they're betting on the hometown boy. They're betting on Hatton.
Exactly. Hey, real quick thing. The best English fighter there is right now is a guy named Joe Kazaki, and he is...
Oh, I've seen him. He's amazing.
He is a true scientific boxer. He knows everything. He's undefeated. And,
yes. Is he a Welsh? Is he from Wales?
Yes. His father...
Yes, he's dark-haired. I've seen him. He's amazing. Very fast.
Fast and very good. He's a last of the scientific fighters, and I'm afraid that this lad from England's fighting next Saturday. He don't have too much of a chance because this guy's really good. He's fighting.
Yes. So Mayweather is a skilled fighter and strong as a leopard, and the English fighter you say is not even in his league. Basically, is what I'm hearing.
I don't think he is, but he is tough. But and he's undefeated. And he's
he's tough. He's a tough guy. Hatton is the kind of guy that, as I say, you would have seen in a longshoreman years ago, right? Wouldn't you say so, Mark?
Well, I would say so, but a lot of people don't understand boxing. Boxing is almost like a scientist, you know, comparing Einstein with a lesser scientist. There is more to boxing than just getting up there and being strong and big muscles. And like I say, this is Joe Kazaki. He has all that. Jonas had it. A lot of, it can get...
Yes. I hear you. There's a lot of brains involved. It's not just brawn. That's the whole beauty of boxing as opposed to the extreme fighting, which, of course, you have to have brains for that as well. But it's so brutal. It's a different world. Thank you for the call. Time, again, is short in these little segments. Dale in Wisconsin, you're up on the Savage Nation. What's on your mind?
Yeah, hi, Michael. It's an honor. It really is.
Thank you.
I have a 3-month-old baby at home, and he's sick. And I've heard recently with new findings that the over-the-counter medicine for infants was found not to work. I was wondering, with your background, if you could lead me in any...
Well, let me say this. I cannot give medical advice on this program, but I suggest that you investigate never using those medications for an infant. And I mean the over-the-counter cough medications and the others. I think they're highly dangerous, the ingredients themselves and the additives and the adulterants are very dangerous. So you say, well, where does that leave you? Having an infant who's sick is probably one of the most disturbing things that could happen to a new parent because you feel helpless. Isn't that correct, Dale?
Yes, exactly, Michael.
Okay, so you got to go to the basics at that point. Have you taken the baby to a doctor?
Yes, we have. And
what's the diagnosis of from the medical point of view?
Just upper respiratory thing. You know, it's the same thing they tell you every time you go to the hospital. And
all right, so they think at this time it's something like an influenza, a flu, a bad cold?
Yeah, a bad cold, a common cold.
Okay, and have you paid attention to your infant's diet?
Yes, extremely.
Okay, so you're giving the baby a lot of fresh juices, orange juice and things of that nature?
He's not to that point yet. It's strictly formula. We were breastfeeding, but she wasn't producing and she dried up, so we had to stop.
All right. Now, I understand. So you've got that situation. Now, you're going to formula, which is several degrees below breast milk. In colostrum, there was no colostrum. Did he get breastfed when he was born?
Yes, in the beginning.
Now, let me send you Healing Children Naturally for free. Look into it.
Savage.
It is the Savage Nation. Look what we're talking about. It's funny, you know, I came up with the story that the intelligence on Iran is fraudulent, that Iran is working feverishly to produce an atomic bomb. It doesn't make it to the newspapers, and you yourself are not interested in it. We're stunned that the National Intelligence Council is chaired by a Thomas Fingar, a left-wing operative who has shifted position as near as from 2 days ago. This man should be investigated by Congress as a spy for Iran. If it was me, if I was in the FBI, I would haul Thomas Fingar for a lie detector test to make sure the guy is not working for Iran. That's all I can tell you. But the country I live in is not the country that is. The country in my head is not the country I live in, okay? I don't know who's in charge of anything anymore. How do you have a guy in the State Department who for 5 years tells you that Iran is on the road to developing a nuclear bomb, and then the minute the surge is shown to be working in Iraq, he comes up with a fraudulent report that Iran is not producing a nuclear bomb and hasn't for 5 years, and we find out who the guy is, and that he's a far-left operative, and the man is not hauled into the FBI headquarters and wired up to a lie detector. What kind of country are you living in? We don't know who to believe anymore. That's the problem. That's why people have no faith in government. When you see the spies, the agents of foreign governments, and if it's not true that he's an agent of a foreign government, then he's an agent of Hillary Clinton and the Democrats trying to undermine Republicans without regard to what effect it will have on our national security. Don't you get what I'm saying to you? It has never, ever been this bad. Never. Kevin in Ocala, Florida, welcome to the Savage Nation.
How you doing, Dr. Savage? You was talking about earlier about what defines a man. Jesus said this in Matthew chapter 7. He said this. He said, "Wherefore, by their fruits ye shall know them." And I think the fruits that people bear on this earth, they'll be known by, whether it be good fruit or be rotten fruit. And I think you've produced good fruit over the years. And no matter what care is trying to do against you, it's not going to work, because Paul in his epistle to the Galatians, he said this, that you be not weary in your well-doing, because God is not mocked. Whatsoever a man soweth, so shall he reap. And you've sown good things all these years to so many people, including the Apostolic Pentecostal, which I am, all right? And don't be weary in your well-doing, doctor. You're going to
win. Well, God bless you. I tell you, it's the prayers of the Christians that are keeping me going. You think I'm making it up?
Oh, no.
I got to tell you something. It's the candles that have been lit for me and the prayers that are being made for me that keep me going. Period. End of story. I hear them and I feel them. And I know you people are moving angels in heaven for me. And I thank you very much for your prayers. And I mean that from the bottom of my heart. I don't know who you are, many of you, but I know what it means. Now, I want to talk about other topics other than me and this case. It's in the courts. It has been assigned to a judge now. The judge will decide what to do with it very shortly. It is out of my hands. It will be in the hands of the American judicial system. I have the best possible attorney, and I'm just gambling on truth prevailing here. And the law, by the way, there's a very strict law on copyright infringement, and that's what we're dealing with right now. My material, misappropriated, used to destroy me, and now we're going to turn the tables on them. By their own petard, shall we, you know what. You can't rip people off and say you didn't do it. And you can't claim I'm a public figure as they're already screaming and they could do anything they want. It doesn't work that way. You can make up anything you want. The courts won't see it that way, I'm pretty sure. Los Angeles, Jeff, you're on the Savage Nation. Go ahead, please.
Hey, Michael, how you doing? Listen, I have some insight for you as to why the Ukrainians and Russian athletes are so tough, because I've worked with a lot of the best, like world and Olympic champions that come from those
okay.
countries.
Okay, why are they so tough?
Number one, it's how they train. You know, the Soviet bloc is, regardless of the weather, they would go out with freezing snow, and they would be wearing shorts and T-shirts. And the philosophy is that if you were strong enough to survive the training, you were going to make a good athlete.
Wow.
And second of all, it's like they never brought a doctor or therapist to any competition because they felt that if you brought a doctor or a therapist that you were going to get injured or sick, so they didn't bring them.
And you mean it would like jinx you?
Yeah, absolutely right. They, you know, they're very superstitious. I mean, my wife is Russian and Lithuanian, and they're very, very superstitious people, and they just really feel that you've got.
But isn't there a genetic element to the toughness of the new breed of Russian athlete?
I would say 100%. I mean, I've worked and touched these guys in what
you think about natural selection. You know how many Russians were killed in World War II and how many died in World War II? 3 million Russians died in the Battle of Stalingrad alone. You're aware of that, aren't you, Jeff?
Yeah, 100%. I mean, they ate trees, they ate dirt, they ate everything, but they didn't give up. And that's exactly
they wouldn't give up. And they counter when they counterattacked the Nazi butchers, and they swept in out of the north. The Germans didn't know what hit them. You know, we could never sustain any kind of war like that. You know that, Jeff. It's impossible to perceive this country could ever sustain that. It's impossible. It would never happen. And that's why we have to use the big weapons we have, and we're not using them, and that's what worries me. If we're not capable of fighting like that, and we don't have the guts to use the weapons we have, we're a sitting duck for China. Let me tell you something. The Chinese are just as tough as the Russians, if not tougher. That would be my guess. How would you take that statement? Would you agree or disagree with that statement?
No, I mean, 100%. I'd give you some examples of that, because the equipment that we used in these very, very sophisticated competitions, are extremely primitive. It's like the guys from the eastern countries, they could care less about what equipment they're given, because they know at the end of the day, they're the guys that have got to stand up and make stuff happen through their own efforts. Completely different mindset, 100%.
Yeah, but I mean the Chinese as, let's say, Chinese military, Chinese troops. Many of these kids come out of the peasantry of China. They are used to deprivation. They have been near starvation most of their youth, which is why they went into the Chinese military. Wouldn't you agree that they're as hard as nails?
It's exactly the same thing. You look at the Belgian athletes the same way. They got the freezing cold, and they got the wind coming off the North Sea, and these guys get up and they go to work, regardless of what their athletic endeavor is. I mean, these people are...
And we have school moms now and the sissies in the school system eliminating games like tag because it may hurt somebody's self-esteem. We have homosexual lessons day and night in the school system. We have people being told to be ashamed for being a male and having blood in their veins. How can we ever survive as a nation with this sissification and homosexualization of our nation?
It's not possible. And I have another very funny story to tell you with this regard. It's like the Soviet athletes that I was talking with, they said that they actually brought in a sports psychologist to talk to them to get a little bit more motivation to get those guys to perform better.
Right.
And the sports psychologist was actually a member of the KGB. And he got this one guy aside and talked to him about the expectations for him performing and that they expected great things from him because he was an Olympic and a world champion many times over. And the sports psychologist told him that if he doesn't perform, he's going to have to kill him.
Hey, I'm not surprised. I've watched the Chinese acrobats in Olympic trials or Olympic competitions. And the reason they'll go to the limits and breaking limbs is they know that if they lose, their life is over. Not necessarily that they're going to be executed, but they may as well be executed for what fate awaits them back in China. They're not going to have a psychologist waiting for them. And another school mom asking him what kind of closure they would like with therapy. So what are you going to do about a nation that's become Romanized? When I say Romanized, I mean almost like the ancient Roman Empire. I don't understand that we have the greatest weaponry on earth, and here we are fighting a ragtag group of urban guerrillas, and we're not killing them. Instead, we're negotiating with them. It's unbelievable to me, my friend, and I'm very worried for the future of our nation when we have Islamo-fascist external and front groups for Islamo-fascist internal, if you know who I'm referring to.
Of course.
Thanks for the call. And then we have people in this country who don't even know the danger they're in, on top of it all. But that's why, I guess, why we love athletes. Tough athletes. There's still an instinct in all of the malehood in this country to want to see tough men competing. It's a part of human nature. Fighting, human struggle, is in our genes. It's deeply genetically coded. No matter what the feminists have tried to do to this country, the men still are men inside, particularly outside of New York City and Los Angeles. Chicago, Illinois. John, you're on the Savage Nation. Go ahead, please.
Thank you, Michael. Yeah, talking about the toughness of Russian athletes, Gustav Abrakotos, the gentleman that worked with a Texas senator, the subject of an upcoming movie, in a war in Afghanistan, a clandestine war in Afghanistan, is an exact example. His family came over from Greece. They came through Ellis Island. He grew up in the Pittsburgh steel mills. In the ghettos that surrounded the Pittsburgh steel mills when they were owned by Jones and Laughlin, tough street living. They were not brought up with a sense of entitlement. They had to scrap their way to live and make a living. In the end, this guy winds up being one of the toughest CIA operatives ever, and conducted at least an interesting, if not also successful, clandestine effort in Afghanistan.
Yes, but look, here's the problem, John. Today we have people inside the CIA and the other intelligence agencies who would probably not even hire a man like that today for saying he's too macho. I'm telling you like it is. They probably have a group of freakazoids inside these companies, inside these agencies, like inside America's corporations, saying he's too tough, he's too hard, he's too American. Don't hire him. Hire some softling. Hire a softling who you could turn into a pillowcase. That's why we're losing every way you turn. How much further do you have to go than what happened here in this country over the last 3 days? How much further do you have to go? For 5 years, they're telling us Iran is building a bomb, on the road to building a bomb. The centrifuges are running. Iran's going to have a bomb. We got to stop Iran from building a bomb. And every day the Democrats are singing, oh, we can't attack Iran. Oh, negotiate with Iran. They know that they can negotiate us to death with these quislings inside the Democrat Party and half the Republican Party. They know how to wait it out for a Hillary victory, God forbid. So what they do is now Iraq suddenly turns and it looks hopeful for a few weeks. And all of a sudden people are saying maybe the surge is working. Maybe Bush wasn't wrong. Maybe Bush and Cheney were right. And suddenly Iraq is off the table as an issue in the presidential election. So what does Hillary tell her minions to do and her plants and her enemies within the State Department and elsewhere? She says switch the intelligence now and say Iran doesn't have a nuclear weapon, hasn't been on the road to a nuclear weapon. Iran is a peace-loving nation. And the newspapers in overdrive, they're spring. Oh, no nuclear weapon, no nuclear weapon. All a lie of the Bush and Cheney. So what this is going to do, frankly, is push Bush and Cheney into a corner where they're going to have to act without the Congress to take out Iran's nukes. And they'll do it. And they'll do it, no matter what the New York Times and the other freakazoids say. I'll be right back.
Savage.
Briefly talk about theology and the candidates, because it's become a big issue. They started by attacking Romney because of his Mormon faith, which I found offensive. I found it nauseatingly offensive, to be frank with you, that they keep ripping at Romney because he's a Mormon. And now, of course, there's this big flap over the Obama email suggesting that he's a Muslim who wants to destroy the United States by being elected to its highest office. A Clinton volunteer has quit over this Obama email, and she forwarded a chain email that suggests Barack Obama is a Muslim who wants to destroy the United States by being elected to its highest office. Now, first of all, Obama is currently a member of the United Church of Christ and has never been a Muslim, according to what the Obama campaign is coming out. They're saying that it's a hoax email that has been circulated, which suggests Obama is some sort of a Manchurian candidate for Muslims. Now, where did this come from? Since we're talking about Mormonism and everybody else's faith, let's evaluate this and see if it's a lie or there's any, even a scintilla of truth in this. The email that was forwarded by this Clinton campaigner points out that Obama's father and stepfather were Muslim. That's a fact. Those are facts. Those are facts. It's also a fact that Obama lived in Indonesia for part of his childhood. These are undeniable facts. But other parts of the email are being said now to be false. They say that Obama attended public and Catholic schools in Indonesia, not a radical Islamic school. They're also saying that Obama never used the Quran instead of the Bible when sworn into office, or that he ever admitted to being a Muslim. So there's a few questions that I think only Obama can answer, not anyone else. The fact of the matter is that he did attend school in Indonesia. It is a fact of reality that his father and stepfather were Muslim. He has to now come out and say that, well, that is true, and he loves his stepfather and father, but that he is a practitioner of the Christian faith, and that he has to come out and say something here. That's my opinion. But we do know that a Clinton volunteer has quit over the Obama email. That's also an issue right now. And the only way to resolve this is for Obama to step out right front and center and lay it on the line. I mean, what does he believe in? Did he ever go to a madrasas? Yes or no? Why hide from it? Answer it. And if he went to a madrasas, say it. Because it's going to come out by the time this election comes up. If you didn't go to a madrasas, fine, say it. Lay it on the line. This, to me, is more important than whether you smoke marijuana. It's more important to me than some of the other rubbish we're having them debate about. Terrible tragedy in the Midwest. Maniac teenager takes a rifle, goes into a mall, kills 9 people, then kills himself. Of course, you won't see any pictures of him right away because he does not look like Timothy McVeigh. You won't see pictures of those he killed either because they're all of a certain race, and you can't have it. Unless it was the other way, then you could have it immediately. Then Wolf Blitzer trips over himself to report it. But in either case, it's a tragedy. It is a horror. You go to a mall now and a maniac comes there with a gun? Well, of course he has an excuse. You're reading already that he was fired from McDonald's yesterday, so I guess society failed him. There was no closure. There was no therapy. There were no therapists to hold his hand when he got fired from McDonald's. So, well, the only thing to do that in that case is pick up a gun and kill innocent people in a mall. Now, of course, if everyone had been armed in the mall, there'd be only one dead person, probably him. So that's an argument for more conceal and carry laws in the country, not less. The killing was done with a rifle. So don't give me the seize the guns garbage. Everybody should be packing a gun. And there'll be less murder, not more. 1-800-449-8255, phone number. Any topic is fair game. I don't know what you want to talk about. There's tremendous consequences on this Iran issue. Tremendous consequences. Frank, go ahead, please. You're on the Savage Nation.
Yeah, Mike, why do you think the Democrats would want to buy into this report, whereas if Bush says, okay, fine, there's no weapons, he does nothing, and then, God forbid, Hillary gets elected, and then he does have them, then she's got to deal with it.
I don't know what you're saying. You say Bush knows that he has weapons, but he's glad that he doesn't have to deal with it?
No, if Bush goes along with this report and says, okay, fine, there's no weapons, he doesn't attack, and he just lets this thing lie. And it turns out there are weapons. Later on, you got Hillary in office, and now she has to deal with him.
Sure, it's a pass for Bush if you think he's that cynical, which is, you know, it's like now he doesn't have to do anything in his last year and a half or whatever. He could just coast.
Not really what his thoughts on it. What about the Democrats if they think, okay, let's go along?
Yeah, well, when a big bang goes off, what, the Democrats will say we didn't know?
Well, she's...
I don't know. Who we're going to get in office, I don't know. But let's say, God forbid, it's a Democrat. We know they're pacifists. We know they're quasi-socialists. And we also know that they would rather avoid war at all costs. So where will that lead us when we have a terrorist nation like Iran who will get the bomb and use it? What do you think is going to happen then?
Oh, they'll have to go after...
See, the big loser here, Frank, is not Bush. The big loser here is Israel. Israel got maneuvered into the situation now of a no-win situation. And they have only themselves to blame for having a quisling like Olmert going along step by step with this nonsense about peace with Condoleezza Rice-Aroni pulling him by the nose into the so-called Annapolis Conference. Israel is the big loser here because Israel's now backed into a corner. What do? They go out and take out a few of the nuke sites in Iran and then provoke all of the Iranian people to hate them when right now most of the Iranian people don't really hate them. They hate Ahmadinejad even more. So where is Israel going to turn now? What are they going to do? I don't know. I'm glad I'm not the leader of Israel. There is no leader of Israel. Israel has no leader. Right now, there is no Israel. Israel's a stage set with movable boundaries, like curtains on a stage. You want the West Bank? Move the curtain to the left. You don't want the West Bank? Move the curtain to the right. You want the Gaza Strip? Move the curtain north. You don't want the Gaza Strip? Move the curtain south. It's a stage set called Israel. It's no longer a nation. Where are its borders? I don't know. Where are Israel's borders? What is its language? Well, it used to be Hebrew. It used to be a Jewish nation. But with multiculturalism and with the American peace movement having poisoned the fiber of the nation itself, Tell me what the national language is of Israel. Moreover, I challenge you to tell me what the culture is of Israel. Tell me what the culture of Israel is built upon. With the multiculturalism that has seeped into Israel from the Quislings from America who have undermined it, tell me what the culture is of Israel. Israel is no more. The Israel you think exists died with Golda Meir.
Savage.
Warning. The Michael Savage Show contains adult language, adult content, psychological nudity. Listener discretion is advised.
And now, America's most exciting radio talk show, The Savage Nation. Here is Michael Savage.
It is the one and only Savage Nation. We have an abrupt about face with the Iran nuclear weapon thing. The Cretan who the other day published a report saying that Iran is not on the road to a nuclear weapon and hasn't been on for 5 years. Just on July 11th, 2007, Thomas Fingar, the same guy who gave America the middle finger just 2 days ago, gave the following testimony before the House Armed Services Committee. And I'm not going to read it to you, but he said that Iran is on the road to Iranian enrichment and blah, blah, blah. And he says, we assess that Tehran is determined to develop nuclear weapons. He said that on July 11, 2007, the same man who gave America the finger just the other day and said that Iran has not been developing a nuclear weapon. So now, if it's true that Dr. Finger crafted this latest intelligence report, why is he not in a chair with a swinging light overhead with a rubber baton in an FBI room? That's what I'd like to know. Welcome to the Savage Nation. Answer, because nobody's in charge of anything. If, on the other hand, you utter a homophobic remark at work, I'm sure that the FBI will be knocking at your door in the near future. And that's what really worries me about America today, which is the pacifism, the political correctness, which is a word I hate using, but unfortunately it's something that you understand very well. You know how insidious political correctness is when a man in the government itself can change his tune on Iran and the nukes and not be called before an FBI investigator? I don't understand how you can let this get away, how a man could get away with this, rather. But there's a lot of things I don't understand. There are many things I don't understand. I don't understand how American advertisers could back an organization like CAIR, let them put their companies on CAIR website, when at least 12 officials with CAIR have either been indicted and arrested or deported over the years. And yet, on the other hand, I, a true American patriot, am somehow questioned. You hear this? That's because most Americans are so gullible, they don't even know the world they're living in. Well, I do, and I am not ashamed to tell you I'm proud of expressing my opinion as a true American should, and it's in the hands of the courts. It was assigned to a judge today. We will see what the judge does very shortly. I have faith in the American judicial system. It doesn't matter whether the judge is a Democrat or a Republican. It doesn't matter to me. The law is very specific. My attorney is very clear. It is a copyright infringement case at this time. They had no right to use my copyrighted material in the way it was used. And I have another question on that case of the CAIR case. Here's another question that occurred to me last night after two beers. There are many civil rights groups in America. Some come to mind, such as the NAACP. I don't know of any other civil rights group in America that sues everybody in sight if somebody says something they don't like. I've never seen a civil rights group do that. The NAACP will rightly get involved in cases that involve protecting the rights of members of the race that they're particularly oriented toward protecting. But I've never seen the NAACP sue people for statements that they've made. I've never seen the ADL sue people for statements they've made. I have never seen any other civil rights group behave in this manner, which leads me to believe that Joe Farah of WorldNet Daily may be right when he says there may be another agenda other than civil rights involved here. And I hope that the American people wake up before it's too late. And if you want to participate in this case, go to michaelsavage.com, look at the lawsuit, and make your own decision. Now go to the callers, Michael. I will. Giovanni, KNEW, quickly, what's on your mind? Go ahead, please.
Yes, sir. I would question the timing of this release of this this report. It seemed to me that during the primaries, the...
You mean the report the other day, right, on the suddenly that Iran has no nukes and hasn't been able to and shut down its weapons program in 2003. That came out the other day from this guy, Fingar, right?
Yes, sir. And I'm just...
Yeah, well, there's an awful lot on this. And on my website, the article by Kenneth Timmerman is something you must read. Plus, we have an updated article on it from today that came out in the Weekly Standard showing you that this very same man, Fingar, reported as near as in last spring that Iran was on the road to developing nuclear weapons. In fact, he gave a testimony on July 11, 2007, which was last summer, four or so months prior to the most recent analysis by this Mr. Fingar. He said that Iran was determined to develop nuclear weapons. I'd like to know what made him change his opinion. I'd like to know why there's no congressional hearing before we change our tune with regard to the Hitler of our times. Up next is a gentleman named Robert Zubrin on breaking the hold of OPEC and the Saudis, the hold that the Saudis and OPEC have on our life and our survival. He has some ideas on this and why this administration is so wed to oil. Right here on the Savage Nation, and I suggest you listen very, very carefully, because this story is a very important one with regard to whether we should break our addiction to oil and what it's going to do to us if we don't. As Americans, we're giving away $1 billion a day to OPEC. We can't keep it up, especially if our dear friend Chavez gets his way and oil jumps to $200 a barrel. Dr. Robert Zubrin has written about the dangers this country faces in the near future if we don't find alternative means to fuel our country. It's called Energy Victory. Dr. Zubrin, thank you for being with us.
Mike, thanks for having me on the program.
First of all, could you please explain how the stranglehold of Middle East oil and how it's destroying our economy?
Well, it's attacking the whole world economy. You've got something like $2 trillion last year being looted from the world economy to go for grossly overpriced oil, and about half of it has been going to OPEC countries to use to fund the dissemination of terrorist ideology, in particular Saudi Arabia. Set up over 20,000 madrasas around the world, not even counting those inside of Saudi Arabia, teaching young boys that the way to go to paradise is to kill Christians, Hindus, Jews, Buddhists, whomever. That, you know, they're sending the foreign fighters into Iraq to attack our troops. And, you know, they're actually committing acts of murder, mayhem, terrorism, and genocide everywhere from Biafra in Nigeria out through the Middle East and all the way to Indonesia. So this is something we should stop supporting.
Why is it that our current leadership on both sides of the so-called aisle is allowing this to happen?
Well, in some cases, it's probably just stupidity or inertia. But in other cases, there's clearly evidence of corruption here. You take Spencer Abraham, who was President Bush's Secretary of Energy during his first term and who pushed this complete phony policy called the hydrogen economy, which had no chance of working. He is now a paid lobbyist for Saudi Arabia. Okay, and, you know, you have practically every major think tank in Washington, D.C. is getting Saudi money, all the major lobbying organizations, Patton Boggs, the biggest lobbying organization in Washington with 400 lawyers on staff, is registered with the U.S. Department of Justice as an agent of the Saudi government. Akin Gump, a leading Democratic Party law firm, Verdon Jordan's the head of it, they've taken Saudi money. You've got Saudi Ambassador Prince Bandar giving Jaguars to Colin Powell, you know, the Saudi royal family giving a $4 million contract to James Baker, the author of the Iraq report, for his law firm to defend them against the families of the 9/11 victims. It's kind of hard to have an organized policy when you've got a political elite in Washington willing to take the enemy's money.
Well, aside from yourself, are there any other reliable sources reporting on this? It seems like every time we hear about energy in the news, it's about high gas prices and how they're too high, but there's never any follow-up. What's really at the root of all this?
Well, at the root of all this is OPEC, the oil cartel. Okay, we do not have a free market in oil. The oil market is effectively controlled by Saudi Arabia through a cartel of 10 other dictatorships, including the other Arab countries and Venezuela. And they meet together in a room, and they decide what the price is going to be. And they if you look at the OPEC oil production, it's totally erratic. They increase production, they decrease production in order to manipulate the price. And we have to take this power out of their hands. You know, Hugo Chavez right now is calling for sending the price of oil to $200 a barrel. And unless we break their vertical monopoly, they have the power to do that. But there is a way to stop them.
Briefly, what is your plan for ending this and putting OPEC in its place?
It requires just one government action. After that, it becomes a market-driven solution. The government action that is required is for the U.S. Congress to pass a law mandating that all new cars sold in the United States, whether they're made here or made overseas, be flex-fueled, that is able to run on either alcohol or gasoline. This kind of car already exists. There's 24 models being put out by Detroit this year. That have this capability, they only cost $100 more than the same car without the flex fuel option. Okay, but what this would do, you see, is within 3 years of such a mandate, you'd have 50 million cars on the road in the United States capable of choosing between alcohol and gasoline, and over 100 million overseas, because these cars would be sold all over the world. And gasoline would be forced to compete against something else. It would be forced to compete against methanol or ethanol everywhere in the world right at the pump, which means they could not drive the price up as high as they please. In fact, what it would do is drive the price of oil right back down to $50 a barrel, because that's where alcohol fuels generally become competitive. And so it would take this power out of their hands. And $50 a barrel oil, which is more than a fair price, okay, that would completely smash Mr. Chavez, because his oil is the most expensive of the OPEC oil. And it would hurt the Iranian government a lot. They would not be able to afford a nuclear bomb program. And the Saudis would make some money, but they'd make only half as much money. And it would benefit our economy tremendously, and even more so, it would protect the world's poor. You know, Chavez says that he is the great friend of the world's poor. He's the worst enemy of the world's poor, because, you know, it's one thing for you and I to pay $100 a barrel for oil. It's another thing for a farmer in Kenya who makes a dollar or two a day to pay $100 a barrel for oil. That price means he can't pay for the truck ride to get his crops to market. That means his family starves to death. You know, oil price rigging is a tremendous regressive tax against the world's poor, and in defending ourselves against it, we defend the whole world against it.
What is OPEC spending this oil money on now, both in the Middle East and in Venezuela? And if your plan were to be adopted, how would it affect the geopolitics of the world, say, 10 years down the line?
Okay, well, the Saudis are the leader of OPEC. They are the largest producer in OPEC. They produce as much as the next four members of OPEC combined. And they control the rest, because they can actually produce oil cheaper than the rest. So if anyone breaks their quota, they can threaten to increase production and lower the price, and it hurts the others more than it hurts them. So that's how they keep the thing under control. Now, what have they been using the money for? Okay, and by the way, they got $200 billion last year in oil revenues. That's up from $2.7 billion in 1972. Okay, they've used, well, a lot of it has been used on pure waste, palaces, yachts, concubines, cocaine, thoroughbred racehorses, all this sort of junk. Okay, but they've also spent hundreds of billions of dollars promoting terrorism. They've created a network of over 20,000 madrasas around the world that teach young boys to kill non-believers, Christians, Jews, Hindus, Buddhists, so forth, Shiites. They have created an entire alphabet soup of organizations, the Muslim World League, the World Association of Muslim Youth, et cetera. There's a whole bunch of them. I go in the book Energy Victory, I go through a lot of them and show how they're funded and what they've done. But, you know, they created over 1,000 of these madrasas in Pakistan alone. That's how they created the Taliban. Okay, they're behind the genocide in Darfur. They're behind this insurrection in Algeria against relatively progressive or moderate anyway, Muslim government, which killed over 150,000 people. They're carrying out pogroms against Buddhists in Indonesia. They're killing ethnic Russians in Central Asia. Okay, they're, you know, the foreign fighters coming to Iraq that are killing our troops. Most of them are Saudis, and the rest are Arabs that have been educated in these Saudi academies in other Arab countries. Killing our troops, blowing up pet markets to try to prevent any kind of reconciliation in Iraq, keep the civil war going, get everybody else killing each other. That's what they're doing. The money, of course, is also going to Iran. They're using it to fund their nuclear bomb program. They're also using it to fund Hezbollah. And by the way, Iran is working with Venezuela. They have established Hezbollah training camps in Venezuela. Right now, you know, people are upset about Mexicans coming across the border. That's nothing. Those people are well-meaning people just looking for work. You can say what you will, but it's a different story if Hezbollah starts coming across the border. And that's what we're going to be getting, courtesy of OPEC and Hugo Chavez. And the way to break them is to take their money away. You know, the Iranians could not have a nuclear bomb program if they didn't have the money to pay for it. And the Saudis could not be doing this kind of thing. And not only that, these tyrannies, I mean, even Russia, which is not a member of OPEC, is moving towards tyranny because of the high price of oil, which is allowing the government to function independent of any real organic institutions in the country. In other words, a country becomes an oil well attached to an army, then, you know, dictators take over. This is the formula for petro-tyranny. It's what you have in Saudi Arabia. The only way these countries are ever going to be free is if you actually break their oil oligarchies.
What are the consequences for us and the rest of the world if we don't take action on this?
Well, if we don't take action, they're gaining power. I mean, the Saudis right now are buying Citibank, okay? They're taking over our financial institutions. They're taking over our media. They have bought 5% of CNN, or of AOL Time Warner, rather, that owns CNN. They have actually bought a share of News Corp that owns Fox. They bought a lot of media in Europe. When the Danish cartoons came out and this French newspaper, Le Soir, published them, the editor was fired immediately because guess who was the owner of his paper? In Arab. And they've been taking, this is how they're taking over Europe. We're going to lose the Atlantic Alliance, and we're losing control of our own country as well. So we have to fight back. And the ironical thing is, the way to fight back, it wouldn't cost the Treasury a penny to pass this regulation mandating that the cars be flex-fueled. It wouldn't cost the consumer hardly anything. It would just mean that every car that's produced would give the consumers a choice between buying what Hugo Chavez and the Saudi terrorists are selling or buying what American farmers or Latin American farmers are selling. And if we did this, we would create a market in this country for alcohol fuels that would, in fact, be much greater than what the American farmers could produce to meet. That's a good thing. We can give them all the business they can handle and have more left over for our neighbors south of the border. So we could drop our trade barriers and let in ethanol made from sugar in the Caribbean or in South America or other kinds of crops. And the Europeans could do the same for Africa and the Japanese for South Asia. And so that would be an engine for world development. We'd be taking $1 trillion a year that's now going to the Saudis and other OPEC countries to fund terrorism. We give it to the world's farmers. And so instead of selling Citibank to Saudi princes, we could be selling tractors to Latin America.
Well, the dangers you outline are clear and real. Dr. Zubrin, thanks for your time.
Mike, it was great talking with you. And if people want to find out more, there's a website, energyvictory.net.
Savage.
In the news about possible terrorist cells within the U.S. They tell us we may have had terrorists cross our borders illegally, but they never tell us what kind of threat we're actually facing. They use the scare tactics, and we never get any follow-up. Until now, I've asked Mr. David Yerushalmi to come talk about his Mapping Sharia in America project. Thank you for joining us, Mr. Yerushalmi.
Michael, first of all, it's great to be talking to you. And let me just say on behalf of myself and all of my colleagues that consider you a American patriot and hero for your battle against CARE.
Well, we suspect there's a dangerous problem with sleeper cells in the country. Would you tell us what you and your organization, the Mapping Sharia Project, know about the realities of this? What exactly is the status of sleeper cells, that is, jihadists, people who wish to impose Sharia law in the United States?
The Mapping Sharia Project is essentially, we were looking at a problem. Everyone recognizes Islamic terror throughout the world. There has been a very important major study by the New York Police Department on the recruitment for jihadists here in the United States, and they looked at the recruitment of jihadists in Europe, case study after case study, and they looked at those that have occurred here in the United States. What they found was that the profile, what they call the pre-radicalization stage, was Muslim males between the ages of 18 to 35, wealthy or better than average income, educated, fully assimilated. They get to that recruitment age, they go off to university, they find their way to a mosque as they're leaving their parents' home, looking for their roots. And lo and behold, they find themselves in a mosque in front of an imam or other spiritual advisor who begins the process of what they called self-identification toward radicalization. And what does self-identification mean? It simply means that they begin to learn what it means to be a Sharia-adherent Muslim, meaning a Muslim who adheres to strict Islamic law. And that is the beginning process for the radicalization. And what we wanted to determine through the Mapping Sharia Project is, what is the connection? What is the driving force behind all these jihadists? Is it some political ideology which is modern, or is it driven by a 1,000-year-old Islamic legal tradition which mandates Muslims engage in worldwide jihad? And that's the organizing thesis for the study. And what we do in particular is we send field agents, field researchers, men who are experienced in law enforcement, counterterrorism, and intelligence work, who speak Arabic, Urdu, or Farsi, Arabic obviously for the Arab-based mosque, Urdu for Pakistani mosque, and Farsi for the Iranian mosque. They go in as members of the public, as fellow worshipers, perfectly legal and above board, but they're there to collect data. And the data they collect, on the one hand, is to examine the level of Sharia adherence. How careful are the imams and the individuals in the mosque adhering to Islamic law? How punctilious, how orthodox they are. And then they collect other sets of data, which are measurements for how violent the teachings and the preachings of that particular mosque, the imams that are there, and the worshipers are. And we get that information from a variety of sources, information they hand out, information they sell, answers to specific questions we ask, and all of this is recorded and put into a database. We have a very careful custody chain that we maintain for the evidence that we collect. And when we find very extreme calls for violence, we turn that information over to local law enforcement and federal authorities. The other information is put into a matrix, and it's ranked. And what we're trying to find is the correlation between Sharia or Islamic law, its adherence, and the level for the call for the destruction of the West, for violence and jihad against the United States and other Western countries. What we found to date, and we've covered approximately 100 mosques, and we're going to go to all 2,300 mosques and Islamic day schools in the country over the next year. But after covering 100, what we found is, if you go to a mosque where the imam and or the worshipers are strictly adherent to Sharia, invariably, absolutely, you find calls for violent jihad. And it's in their literature, it's in videotapes, it's in speeches given after the prayer service, it's in private meetings with the imam. All of this material recorded when recording is legal, and videotape when it's legal, and certainly the material we gather from the mosque is carefully documented. What you find also in the few mosques where there's fully westernized, non-Sharia adherent Muslims, and the imam dresses in Western dress, doesn't talk about Sharia, but talks about America and patriotism and so forth. In other words, very low Sharia levels, you find almost no calls for violent jihad. The unfortunate thing that we have to confront is that the vast majority of the mosques that we see across the United States are built around Sharia, Islamic law.
Well, let's level here. What do the worst, the most extreme of these people wish to impose into the United States? If they had their dreams fulfilled, what would America be like?
Well, let's you know, use some names and some real examples. And if I were wrong, I could be sued, you know, and we would defend it on the basis of truth. But we know, for example, that one of the more popular imams in the United States is Siraj Wahaj. His main mosque is called Masjid Taqlid in Brooklyn. He is on videotape telling African-Americans that he's speaking to that they should not be out on the streets today with their Uzis and 9mm, these young men, but they should come in off the streets. They should get, quote-unquote, righteous with Islam and then be sent back out armed and ready for jihad. So that gives you one idea. We have another, a Professor Shakir, who is on videotape. He's a very popular imam, has a PhD from some Western university, and he's held out as the exemplar for moderation. But he's on videotape telling young Muslim children that Congress is guilty of shirk, of being a polytheistic body, which is challenging the divine law of Allah, and that anyone who follows Congress and its laws are also considered mushrik. They're also considered polytheists. And the penalty for being a polytheist or advocating polytheism, that is to say, constitutional government, is death, burning in hell. Now, this is what they're teaching across the United States in private Islamic schools, K through 12th grade. So this gives you an example, both in terms of the radicalization of individuals being converted to Islam in Brooklyn, and Professor Shakir's work in attempting to educate a whole new generation of young American Muslims that they owe no duty to the United States, its constitution and laws. And in fact, worse than that, it is a crime, according to Sharia or Islamic law, to be patriotic and law-abiding, unless that happens to coincide with Sharia law.
How aware is the general public that this degree of Islamofascism exists and walks and talks amongst them?
Well, you know, it's quite obvious that very little, because what we find is once we've identified a violent or violent-prone mosque and we publicize that information, we have enormous feedback from the public and from local law enforcement. Local law enforcement don't realize the threat level in these mosques. But the problem is because we have not identified who the enemy is. We talk about Islamism, Islamofascism, Islamoterrorism, but what we don't understand is that the doctrine, the theological, military, political doctrine that drives all jihadists, all Islamic terrorists, is Sharia law. Sharia law is 1,000 years old. It's been very well documented over that 1,000 years. There are five basic schools of jurisprudence, and each and every one of those schools holds the duty under Sharia of a Muslim is to impose Sharia law around the world. And you do that through persuasion, and if that doesn't work, you do that through subjugation, and if that doesn't work, you do it through violent jihad. That is the driving doctrine that shows up with suicide bombers, shows up with airplanes into Twin Towers. That is the driving force that we have to confront. And until we confront that Sharia itself calls for our violent destruction, we'll continue to kind of bat at the air. Because the problem we have in the United States and elsewhere in the West is that we don't want to contradict President Bush when he says Islam is a noble and peaceful religion. Now, to say that Islam is a noble and peaceful religion is meaningless because, according to most Muslim apologists, Islam can be anything. Any particular Muslim could decide to be a peaceful, patriotic American or not. And that's true. But what we do know is that historical, authoritative Islam is driven by Sharia, Islamic law. And by the way, it is Sharia in the Sudan that requires a teacher who's dedicating her life to helping the Sudanese be whipped or imprisoned for having allowed children to name a teddy bear Muhammad. It is the same Sharia law in Saudi Arabia that allows a rape victim to be lashed and whipped 200 times for having the audacity of even making a claim that she was raped. It is Sharia that allows Iranians to bury women to the waist and stone them to death. That is the law. Anywhere it is in place that leads to the brutalities and the attack on every Western sensibility that exists.
Mr. Yerushalmi, your work is extremely important for the safety of America, and I wish you and your team the greatest success in the battle we all face. Thank you for your dedication to this country.
Michael, thank you very much for having me on. I appreciate it. You have an excellent program that is informing Americans about the very real existential threat that we face with Sharia, i.e. Islamic law. Thank you.
Savage.
Best of times, it was the worst of times. It is the savage times. It is Michael. Phone number is 1-800-449-8255. Let me begin with the obvious. The Mad Hatters in the U.S. Congress. 1890, snowfall tied today in Maine. North Dakota breaks a 1926 snow record. And as I speak with you, the Mad Hatters are meeting in the U.S. Senate to discuss global warming and how to tax us to death. At the same time this country is imploding like Chernobyl, a petty tin pot dictator named Chavez is rising to power in Venezuela. Make no mistake about it, he's in cahoots with the Hitler of our time, Ahmadinejad, who has sent Iranian murderers to train and infiltrate the United States. The ugliest, most frightening man on the planet is Ahmadinejad, and yet he has friends inside the Democrat National Committee who have reported just yesterday that Iran has not been developing nukes since 2003. This very same Quisling, Mr. Fingar, who put out that false report, in July reported that Iran is developing nukes, and yet the FBI does not arrest him and interrogate him. The Republicans in Congress do not immediately call with outrage for a hearing. So the Senate panel, while we have the greatest snowstorm since 1890 in Maine, passed landmark legislation just hours ago combating global warming by limiting carbon dioxide emissions. The bill passed by the Mad Hatters in the Senate would set caps on U.S. greenhouse gas emissions from electric, utility, transportation, and manufacturing industries beginning in 2012. It would create an incentive system that would give credits to industries that cut pollution. Industries that failed to reduce emissions would be forced to buy credits from others. The Democrat-led Senate Committee of Mad Hatters voted 11-8, largely along party lines, to send the measure to the full Senate for action next year. The rhetoric was astonishing. Senator Barbara Boxer, one of the most foolish creatures to have ever come out of a womb in Brooklyn, said the following: "We are facing a crisis that will hit our children and our grandchildren the hardest if we do not act now. Not to act would be wrong, cowardly, and irresponsible," said Boxer. Senator Boxer is expected to fly by jet to Bali as part of a U.S. congressional delegation next week. Said committee approval of the bill sends a signal to the rest of the world that the United States is serious about reducing global warming. This is on a day when a snowstorm hits Maine, equal the last largest snowfall on record in 1890. Now I ask you, how can a country survive that has such lunatics in the United States Senate? How is it possible that we can survive? Barbara Boxer, one of the biggest fools ever elected to the U.S. Senate, should be told, Barbara, North Dakota is buried in snow. It's broken a 1926 record for snow. Barbara, Maine has tied an 1890 record before cars were out there. Barbara, wake up. You're a moron. You're an idiot. You're a psycho. All I can do is disseminate the truth. On my website, michaelsavage.com, I've had article after article for the last 2 years showing you one scientist after another who has dared break with the maniacs and have debunked the part of the global warming myth. Even NASA itself has put out a report debunking a major part of the global warming myth, but the media won't report it. You click on my website, you'll see article after article, international scientist after international scientist. I have dozens of articles. Global warming, the cold hard facts. Scientists respond to Gore's warnings of climate catastrophe. Do you know that one of the scientists in the UN who shared part of the Nobel Prize with Gore came out and said this is an outrage, it's a lie? Do you know that the Greenland ice that was pulled up from 1.2 miles below the surface debunks Al Gore's global warming theories? You didn't read any of this. I will tell you, you've got to read this for yourself. You cannot believe this. It's unbelievable to me that even the Weather Channel founder himself has said global warming is the biggest hoax in history. I'm not making this up. It's been printed, but not in the New York Times. It's been published, but not in the LA Times. It's been disseminated, but not on CNN. I'm a single man alone trying to sound the alarm about radical Islam and about radical environmentalism and so many other radical isms that the burden is becoming a little too great for me. And I need your help. I need your help by listening to the show, by supporting me in my legal battles against this front group called CARE. And also, I need your help in supporting the advertisers who have not only stuck with me, but increased the amount of ad time on this show. And now I'll take a few calls before I leave this evening. We will go to Kansas City, Missouri. Jason on KCMO, welcome to the program. Go ahead, please.
Mr. Savage, thank you for speaking so strongly and so well for so many of us that don't get heard. I'm calling for your help and guidance. I'm a father of four sons, and I see what's coming. The invasion from the south, Chi-Coms and oil barons buying my country's sovereignty, and the swine in the government on both sides, letting it happen as they get rich from it all. When all this
yes, I up, feel as though it's a Bruegel painting, and the pigs are dancing, swilling beer, swilling wine, rolling in fat, with money falling out of their pockets. If I were a cartoonist, that's what I would see, men in striped pants, women in striped dresses, dancing in the Senate, with money falling out of their pockets, swilling beer, swilling wine, and stuffing their faces with pork. That's what I would see. It's a horrible, it's actually a George Gross painting, not a Bruegel painting. Jason, I don't have an answer other than to disseminate the truth, because there is a saying from the Bible that says, the truth shall set you free. I don't know whether it will set us free. I see the pigs dancing, my friend, and that's all I see. When I see former senators like Bob Dole going to work for the UAE, when I see that hag, Madeleine Albright, lobbying on behalf of the UAE to turn the port security over to the United Arab Emirates, when I see one senator after another quitting to go to work for the highest price, I too, my friend, am concerned about the future of America. And with God's will and your listenership, we shall prevail. At the end of the day, we shall win because we're right and we're good and they're garbage.
Savage.